Krusty, do you think about your father a lot?
All the time. Except when I'm at the track, then it's all business.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to an eargasmic edition of the U.S. Racing Sports Gambling Show. I am your friendly host, Derek Simon, and this is the show where we talk about everything and anything related to the world of gambling. And today, I'm excited because I've just got so much great stuff to share with all of you. And we're going to start by telling you some things you need to know.
I'm looking forward to completing your training. In time, you will call me Master.
Alrighty then.
I learn it from a book.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're gonna remember this the rest of your life.
Oh, I already knew that.
I don't get it.
What part didn't you understand?
Will you never learn?
Help you, I can. Yes.
Well, first and foremost, on the horse racing front, Andrew Beyer, the guru of speed figures, of course, the Beyer speed figures in the daily racing form since 1992, is making a change to turf figures. And he was on with Steve Bick, and they talked a little bit about the process. I personally don't think this can be done. This is the problem with speed figures, and I think it's why Beyer has gotten so much grief over the years. It's really just a measurement of how fast the horses are going. But it's morphed into something much more than that, and something that I think is not as meaningful. It's almost like an ability rating now. The ratings are very subjective, whereas when Beyer first came out with the numbers, they were not. In fact, a lot of people still think that they're made with par charts and all this kind of stuff. They're really not. It's more a look at, okay, what did this horse do last time? And looking at horses that are more consistent, and that kind of establishes the par or establishes the figure. And of course, all that is based on Beyer's previous work. And I've mentioned before, what happens when you start doing this is you start getting an erosion of the figures. Because if a horse that usually runs, let's say a 100 Beyer figure, runs in a race and wins it, the natural inclination is to give that horse a 100, even if it was a great performance. In fact, we can use American Pharoah as an example. American Pharoah in the Classic recorded a 120 Beyer figure. I guarantee you, well, I guess I can't guarantee it, but my bet is if that race was close, the figure would have been 115, 114, somewhere in that area. I think the only reason that the Beyer team felt comfortable stepping outside of that range, which had already been established by most of the horses in that race, you know, no horse in that race had run a 120 Beyer before. And the reason I think they felt comfortable assigning that number is because American Pharoah won in a dominant fashion. If you look at Beyer figures over the years, they've gone down. And a lot of people argue, well, this just proves that horses are getting slower. They're not getting faster. That really doesn't prove anything. So much of what you see in grass racing in terms of the speed figures is dependent on the pace. If you go super slow early, it's not going to be a fast time. Yet, a horse that comes out of a race like that might in fact be a great horse and might in fact have run very, very well in that race. But it was a victim of the pace. Conversely, that same horse that just lagged early, that came home like a world beater, that could beat any horse on the grass, is not going to be able to translate that form on dirt, most likely because dirt races require a certain amount of tactical speed. If we're coming up with figures, and this is what Beyer wants, he wants figures that represent the ability of the horses on both grass and dirt. And he's bothered by the fact that the turf figures are typically lower. But you heard what I just said there. We're really looking at ability at this point. You know, I poked some fun at Timeform in the past for some of the ratings. Well, we're getting to the same point with the Beyer speed figures. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And in reading the comments on the piece that I read at Daily Racing Form called Buyer, Change Coming to Turf, Buyer Figures, some people pointed this out. Of course, some people go into just ridiculous details. Well, you know, the grass is longer. Well, it's shorter. Well, you know, we get different track conditions. Yeah, that's all part of the figure. Or it should be all part of the figure. I just find stuff like that, you know, because if you take that point of view that there's no way that we can quantify this, we wouldn't be anywhere as a society. We wouldn't have MP3 players. How can you quantify sound? Are you crazy? We would have none of this stuff because a bunch of people believe that you can't quantify it. The bottom line is you can quantify most things. That's not the issue. It's whether or not you can do it accurately. In this instance, I don't think you can. But the main thing I wanted to talk about today is odds. It amazes me how many people bet that don't seem to know anything about the odds. There's one guy on my Facebook page who loves to post football plays. And I love this guy because he will post these picks and it's always with a bunch of dollar signs, cha-ching, or my favorite, winner, winner, chicken dinner. Why is a chicken dinner such a big deal to so many bettors? It's like the cheapest food out there. Wouldn't it be better to say winner, winner, lobster dinner? Or, heck, the way salmon is priced anymore, salmon dinner, something. Chicken? I don't get it. Anyway, this guy always does this. He's always, you know, these capital letters. Then he gets mad at me periodically for what reason, I don't know. It's funny stuff. But he's always playing teasers. Now, he doesn't say beforehand that he's playing teasers. He'll say something like, New England is going to crush the Ravens. And then New England wins by 3, and he claims, well, I still won because I had a teaser. So what a teaser is, for those of you who don't know, it's just added points to the line. So if you're playing a 6-point teaser on New England, let's say, and they're a 3-point favorite, so -3 in sports betting parlance, you're getting New England +3. Just adding the 6 to the -3. So to a lot of bettors, this is like free money. It's like, oh my God, I already like the Patriots. Now they can even lose and I still win. And of course, if they lose by 3, typically that's a push. Depends on where you're betting as to how it is scored in a, you know, parlay or teaser. But still, you get the point. It's like, wow, this is great. Well, it's really not so great. In fact, Michael Shackelford, who has been on this program before, he runs the website Wizard of Odds, and it is a fantastic website. If you haven't been there, you need to go there. And he did a study on teasers. This encompassed, I think, about 4,450 NFL games between 1994 and 2012. And he found that the probability of winning just a 2-team 6-point teaser, about 47%. The house advantage, 12%. Now, mind you, when you're playing just a straight wager, the takeout, if you will, is about 9%. The -110 line, to figure out what that means, you just divide 100 by 110. You typically do this for any kind of a negative line. And those are your odds for you horse players who are used to the decimal odds. So it's about a 4-5. Chance or 4-5 odds on a typical point spread wager. So he finds that your chance of winning with 6 points added, 2 teams, 47%. A 12% advantage for the house. Now we're getting into racetrack territory. For 3 legs, it's actually a little bit better for the player. You win about 32% of the time. About a 10% advantage for the house. As you start to go up, when you get to 10 teams in your teaser, your 6-point teaser, 52% advantage for the house. And you see this repeated over and over again. And it really goes back to that old racetrack long shot favorite bias, in that people tend to overestimate the chances of long shots. And it leads to this long shot favorite bias where favorites pay more, or you lose less playing favorites at the racetrack than you do playing long shots. And that still holds true today, although that gap has narrowed. But you see it here as well. So playing the teaser is not a great value. Now, there was a great study done by Stanford Wong in his book, Sharp Sports Betting. And he showed that if you crossed key point spreads, that you can make a profit playing teasers. And according to the study here, that is true. Now, what are those key points? Well, 25% of NFL games, this does not apply to college football, but 25% of NFL games are won by 3 points or by 7 points. In fact, 3 points is by far the most common margin of victory in the NFL. 16% of the time, one team or the other wins by three. 7 points is second at 9%, and then 10 points at 6%. So Wong found that by crossing these key lines, that you can actually make some money. So if you're playing a 6-point teaser, this means that you're looking for teams that are either favored by 8.5, 8, or 7.5 points, or you're looking for underdogs that are getting 1.5 points, 2 points, or 2.5 points. And if you do that, the expected value or your advantage as a player actually goes up to a certain point as you're playing more games. In fact, it steadily increases up to 8 games and then goes down as you play more than that. Once again, that's that favorite long shot bias at work. And you see this in all casinos. They just don't pay a lot of money when you're looking at super long odds, because of course they can take a bath. So players need to be aware of that. But in a 2-team, 6-point teaser, looking at those key lines, you win about 53% of the time, almost 54.002 positive value. When you get to a 4-team teaser, it's a 15% edge. A 3-team teaser is almost 10%. But again, that's a specific situation and very possibly a situation that could go away because the sports books are aware of it. In fact, I read this article. This is by Micah Roberts on Line Makers. Sports betting strategy, exploiting the bet that Vegas books lose most. And according to this guy, Vegas books lose most on 2-team, 7-point teasers. Now, that is not the conclusion that the Wizard of Oz came to in his study. The 6-point teaser crossing those key areas was actually the most profitable. The 7-point was still profitable, but not near as much as the 6-point. So again, anytime there's an edge out there and somebody finds it, and especially when they write about it in a book, those edges can quickly go away. So keep that in mind, because remember, this study, the ending date for Shackelford's study was 2012, and it's now 2015 for those who have lost track of the last 3 years. But something to keep in mind, and it's something that I think everybody should know. If you are playing a teaser, you should know the odds. You should know where those key point spreads are.
Now, here's why you can win.
Every time you lose, you die a little bit. You die inside a portion of you. Not all of your organs, maybe just your liver.
In our business, there is no second place. Either you're first or you're last.
You sick, salty.
I mean, you walk in that door on your two legs all fat and cocky.
You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward.
See that? That's your IQ, buddy. Zero.
If you look at this play, what we're trying to get is a seal here and a seal here. And trying to run this play in the alley.
Remember, we do everything in reps. So if I'm 2 reps of water drinking, usually we do 10 reps of everything. So do another rep of water drinking.
I am pleased to once again be joined by Kevin Rogers. And Kevin, we're going to have to start calling you Kenny Rogers with the way you've been gambling recently. 3-0 last week, 2-1 the first week, with one of those plays basically being no juice because you played an underdog. Congratulations on a great week last week. And what are we looking at this week?
Thank you, Derek, and happy holidays to you. It's a, yeah, obviously it was a great week last week. You got to move on because if you go 3-0 last week and you go 0-3 this week, last week meant nothing. And obviously if you go 0-3 last week, you only look ahead. So it was a good week last week, but now we look ahead to this week. And obviously a lot of big rivalry games inside of college football this week. A couple that I'm looking at, one of them is the annual Stanford Notre Dame game. They're playing in Palo Alto this year. And Stanford lay in 3.5, 4, you know, in that game over the Fighting Irish. I mean, I lean towards Stanford simply because this Notre Dame team is just beat up right now. And, it's been a lot of travel for this team. They went to Pennsylvania 2 straight weeks. They came home. They went to Fenway Park to play Boston College last week. Now they're going out west to, you know, the Bay Area to take on Stanford. And, you know, they had their starting quarterback out. Their starting running back is out. It's just a lot of injuries where the Stanford team, you know, still has got something to play for. Obviously, it's a non-conference game, so, you know, they win this game. It doesn't mean anything for the Pac-12 championship. But for Stanford, they still have an outside shot to maybe, you know, who knows what will happen with this whole top four if everything kind of goes haywire in the final week. So Stanford still has a lot to play for. I just lean towards the home team here. I just think that Notre Dame, it's just so much travel for them and so many injuries. It's very hard to back them on the road.
Hey, Kevin, before we get to the next game, in the previous segment, I talked a little bit about point spreads and odds and so forth. Are there any numbers that you look at that are more important than others, or how important is the line? For example, you know, we talk about these games right now. This is Tuesday. Game's going to be played later in the week. Let's just say it's, you know, -2.5, whatever, goes to -3, goes to -4. At what point do you say, all right, it's no longer a bet?
I would say, I mean, notwithstanding injuries, that, you know, they always have the magic numbers, you know, the 2.5, the 3, you know, don't take it if it goes up to 3.5, because all of a sudden now, you know, you have a game-winning field goal and you end up losing. If you have a team -3.5. I mean, I guess I kind of play it by game-to-game situation and seeing where that number goes. You know, I mean, if you look at, you know, for instance, you know, a team is laying, you know, 1.5 and then it maybe goes up to 2.5. I don't look at that big of a deal because I guess I just look at the odds of how many games you're going to land on 2, for instance. And you know what? If you get squeezed, you get squeezed. And you just don't want to make it a habit and lose too many of the games like that. You know, again, notwithstanding an injury. So if an injury happens and then the line blows up, then, you know, you should just take a step back because now you have different factors involved. But, you know, I'd say take it on a case-to-case basis. You know, maybe it doesn't go more than 2 points. You're still pretty much all right because I just don't think a lot of games are really going to end up in that one number in between when you handicap some of these games.
Yeah, and there's probably an argument to be made that if your handicapping is that finely tuned, probably shouldn't be playing the game anyway, or if it's that dependent on, you know, a half a point or a point or whatever. What's the next game you're looking at?
Another game we're going to look at in college football this week. We're going to take a look and stay out west with the Pac-12, and we're going to look at USC and UCLA. That USC, they were humbled last week against Oregon, an Oregon team that's playing very well down the stretch, that struggled early on, and now they've really found themselves later on in the season. UCLA, they had the strong start, stumbled a bit, and they've kind of come back a little bit. They had a nice win at Utah, but Utah's a team that they faded late in the season. Their running back is out. That, you know, it's a nice win on the road. I'm not going to take anything away from them. But now they play USC in a game where, obviously, big for the city of Los Angeles, and UCLA has won the last 3 in this series, and especially last year, UCLA won at the Rose Bowl big time. So for USC, I'm sure they'll be very focused on this game, that they've had success their last few home games, and that coming back here, in a sense, this can salvage their season, a very rocky season with the Steve Sarkisian firing and just a lot of things going on where there are high expectations for this team. That with USC, you know, sure there'll be some focus going into this game, trying to end this losing streak against UCLA. That USC has still got a lot of talent offensively, and I'll lay the points with the Trojans at home.
Very good. Anything on the pro front? We got the big Turkey Day games as usual.
Nothing for Thanksgiving, but I want to skip ahead to Sunday. And even though this is not exactly the Battle of the Titans, I do like San Diego. They are getting 4 at Jacksonville. And you look at the Chargers, for as much of a mess as they've been, they've still been very good offensively. And I look at Jacksonville, they've won 2 in a row. That they had that miracle win at Baltimore at the end with the penalty that set up the game-winning field goal, and then beat Tennessee last week, a game that they were down most of the way before coming back late. 3 of Jacksonville's 4 wins this year have come by 3 points or less. The 4th win was over Tennessee by 6 points, and that was a game where if Gus Bradley goes for it on 4th and inches and they get it, they run the clock out and they win the game by 3. They elect to go for the field goal, and they take a 6-point lead, and Tennessee went down, and Jacksonville ended up stopping them. But that was the only reason why they won the game by 6, that, you know, Jacksonville probably would have won that game by 3 if they don't go for that field goal. So Jacksonville, when they win very close. And granted, San Diego's going cross country, but for as bad as they've been on the road, the Chargers, you look at some of their losses, they've gone to Minnesota, who has 1 home loss. They've gone to Green Bay, who's very good at home. They've played, at Baltimore. We know the Ravens haven't been very good, but San Diego had them beat, and they end up losing at the end. And now you're getting points against a Jacksonville team that has played better. You can't really dispute that. But I think for the Chargers now, just getting out of town after a couple tough home losses, especially a home blowout loss to Kansas City, then I think them going across the country, you got to take the points against a team that has not been able to show that they can beat teams convincingly.
Kevin, you know, a lot of people use power ratings when they analyze games, whether it's college, pro, whatever. Is that something that you do? Like, do you look at certain teams and think, well, you know, this team is a 70, this team is a 66, therefore, if they play each other, it's a 4-point spread? Or do you just look at every game individually?
I do it more individually. I kind of have in my head, not really like a rating per se, but I kind of look at it and I say, what looks right and what looks wrong when you look at these games? And obviously, football is going to be, the numbers will be tighter in football than they will be, for instance, in college basketball. Because there's so many teams and it's hard for the odds makers to really keep a pulse on it. But I say, like, what looks right and what looks wrong? And if it looks right, you stay away. If it looks wrong, then there's a reason why or something behind it. And that's kind of the way I do it. I personally don't do a lot of the power ratings. You know, you say, well, this team A is playing team B, and here are the factors, and team A is a 4-point favorite. And then I look at what the odds makers put out, and it's a 7-point favorite. I have the edge. I don't really have the edge because I'm not the expert in being an odds maker. Okay. That's their job. What my job is to find the winner. So that's where I don't really buy into, I can make something better than an odds maker, then I'd be an odds maker if that was the case. So I respect what they do and see what they put out and say, okay, how do I exploit this? And that's kind of the way I approach it. I know it's not right or it's not wrong. I know a lot of handicappers out there do the power ratings. That's just something I've just never really done because, frankly, I don't see where there's a huge benefit because they're making the numbers. And then let me see what they do, go against their numbers, and hopefully beat them.
I think that's what I like about you, Kevin, because the people – that I've experienced over the years that think that the markets aren't efficient or think that everybody's a bunch of dunderheads and they're so much smarter are usually the guys not making any money. You got to have a respect for the people that are putting the lines out because ultimately their jobs are on the line. So, you know, they're trying to balance the money and it's going to be generally efficient. Certainly you've done a great job the last couple of weeks. Hopefully we can keep it up in the third week. Want to wish you the happiest of Thanksgivings and talk to you again next week.
Thank you so much, Derek. Same to you.
That is all the time I've got for today. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank my guest, Kevin Rogers. Hope you all have a great Thanksgiving. And speaking of Thanksgiving, remember, go to www.usracing.com for all your sports betting needs, everything and anything. Your little sports betting heart desires is at usracing.com, where we are truly setting the pace. Take care. Talk to you again next week.